Ready?
Yeah.
Great. That means I can't move from here, right? I have to stay. All right, guys. Let's get started. Thank you all for coming. And I think we've gone through all the hurdles possible today. And we've all survived. And I'm glad that you're still here with me. So we started off with a very ambitious project. We wanted to go over a lot of electrolytes today. I was given the task of talking about potassium, calcium, magnesium, and phosphorus. I don't think we can get through all that. Let's start with potassium, since that's the one that you're going to encounter most frequently in your the next couple of years that you're here. So let's look at this first slide, which kind of summarizes how potassium is distributed in the body. Obviously, where do you think most of the potassium is? Intracellular, extracellular? It can be two-way conversation. It can't be just me talking. Okay. So intracellular concentration, as you can see, it's about 3 to 4,000 milliequivalents, whereas extracellular is only about 300 to 400 milliequivalents, right? So how is this compartmentalization? How is it maintained in the body? Any ideas how that might be? Okay, so there's the, obviously, as soon as you ingest a potassium load, it gets transported into the intracellular compartment. Otherwise, we'll all be walking around with high potassiums and having cardiac arrhythmias, but that doesn't happen. So the main mechanisms for the body to redistribute, first is redistribution. Second is getting rid of the potassium, either through the GI tract, sweat, or renally excreted. Potassium comes out of the body. So when you ingest potassium, the first process that takes place is redistribution between the cellular compartments, then the other stuff that we talked about. So this is a picture that depicts what goes on. So there are a few things. So you can see the sodium potassium ATPase, which is the housekeeping transporter on the cell. So as you can see, it pushes potassium. I don't have a pointer, but I guess I'll use this. It pushes potassium into the cells. Sodium leaves the cells. So there are a few things that augment the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase. As you all know, insulin is one of them. And we use insulin to treat hyperkalemia because of this property of insulin. And also beta agonists do the same thing. They increase the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase, and it pushes potassium into the cells. There are other things that the sodium potassium ATPase does, and one of them is a CAMP mediated mechanism, and that's important because we'll talk about it later. It influences the activity of ADH on the cells. So we talked about a couple of things, insulin and beta agonists, as factors influencing transcellular shifts. What are the other things? I think I should go back to the previous slide. Do you guys want to take a shot at it? What are the other factors that influence transcellular shifts? Okay, so what happens in acidosis? Okay, and why does that happen? Okay, so that's basically what it is. So the cell has to maintain electron neutrality. So when you have a lot of hydrogen ions entering the cells, the potassium ions exit the cells, so you get hyperkalemic. And you got to remember that there's a difference between whether the acid that you've added to the body is an organic or an inorganic acid, right? With organic acids, you don't see that much hyperkalemia, whereas in organic acids, you see a lot more hyperkalemia because of the ion that accompanies the acid, okay? Okay, so that's metabolic acidosis. And again, depending on whether it's hyperchloremic or organic, you'll see a severe hyperkalemia or not so bad hyperkalemia. Now, respiratory and acidosis can also cause hyperkalemia, but it's typically not as severe as you would see with metabolic acidosis. Metabolic alkalosis, what do you typically see with metabolic alkalosis? Don't look at the slide. So metabolic alkalosis causes hypokalemia, and it's a vicious cycle. Till you treat the hypokalemia, the metabolic alkalosis doesn't resolve easily. So it helps maintain the metabolic alkalosis. We can't talk about that today because it's a big topic in itself. Pancreatic hormones, we talked about insulin, and insulin pushes potassium into the cells. Glucagon does the opposite. Catecholamines, those are important. Why is it important? Because when you have patients coming in with an MI, what do you expect? Their catecholamines are going to be high, right? So what happens to the potassium? Goes low because the potassium is being pushed into the cell. Why is that important? Because these patients are already having a cardiac event. Now they're more prone to developing arrhythmias because of the catecholaminergic surge. Potassium is going to go into the cells. So it's important to pay attention to their potassiums, not just because it's something that you order. Hyperosmolality, what does that do? It causes potassium to go up. Any idea on how that happens? What happens to the serum osmolality in situations where the glucose is very high? Goes up. So what happens? What are the... Well, if insulin is increased, you would expect the potassium to go down. But that doesn't happen. The insulin actually... Exactly. Very good. So there's a solvent drag because the osmolality is so high. Now water is leaving the cells to come into the extracellular compartment to bring the osmolality down to normal, right? So what happens when water comes out of the cells is it drags potassium, and that mechanism is called solvent drag. So you get a hyperkalemic response in patients who are very hyperosmolar. Aldosterone, we'll talk a little more about it in the next few slides, but aldosterone we know causes potassium secretion. And where does this happen? Okay, in the collecting tube, very good. And with exercise, there are a couple of reasons why patients get hyperkalemic. One of the main ones is that they become acidotic and they become hyperkalemic, but there could also be rhabdomyolysis, release of potassium, and so on. So how does the tubule handle, how does the kidney is the most important mechanism for a human being to balance the potassium in the body, right? We talked about transcellular shifts. That's important. Otherwise, like I mentioned earlier, none of us could have a potassium diet. But eventually, this potassium has to come out of the body. There's only so much transcellular shift that can happen. So the kidney plays a very important role in getting rid of the potassium. So we can look at the different segments of the kidney. So what happens here? It gets filtered. So as you can see in the proximal tubule, most of the potassium gets reabsorbed between the proximal tubule and the thick ascending limb, right? As you can see, almost about 80% of it gets reabsorbed. Only about 10 to 15% reaches the distal part of the tubule. And it's actually in this part, in the collecting ducts, that the fine-tuning or the actual secretion of potassium happens. Everywhere else is just reabsorption. How does the proximal tubule reabsorb potassium? Any idea? Let's start there. So, not in the proximal tubule, right? Aldosterone is distal. What about the proximal tubule? Right, so in the proximal tubule, it's actually very passive reabsorption of potassium that happens. It absorbs a lot of stuff, right? Bicarbonate, it absorbs phosphorus, it absorbs everything in the proximal tubule. So, potassium is just one of the things that gets reabsorbed passively. How about in the thick ascending limb? How does it get reabsorbed? Any ideas? One person at a time. Can be a chorus. Ajit? Okay, so sodium potassium 2-chloride channel, and we'll see that in the picture in the next couple of slides. In the distal collecting duct? Okay. And distally is where we are going to talk a little more about it because that's the part where the fine-tuning actually happens. And eventually you get rid of some potassium. The amount of potassium that is excreted in the body depends on what your body's needs are, right? Okay. So this is a proximal tubule, tubular cell. This is a lumen where you have the ultrafiltrate coming from the glomerulus. This is the blood side of the compartment. So potassium just gets reabsorbed passively in the proximal tubular piece of the equation. This is the thick ascending limb. This is the sodium-potassium 2-chloride channel that we just mentioned. Here's the sodium-potassium ATPase at the basolateral side. These are the chloride channels. So this is a housekeeping transporter. We mentioned that it's present in almost every cell in the body. So sodium leaves the cells. For every 3 sodiums, 2 potassiums enter the cell. And this is the sodium potassium 2 chloride channel on which Lasix acts. So when you block this channel, what happens? With Lasix, you block this channel, then what happens to potassium? That's why you get keliuresis, because you're blocking reabsorption of potassium here. Okay? Now this just sums up everything in this picture, proximal tubule passive reabsorption. This is a thick ascending limb. And this is the, anyone wants to take a guess which cell this is? Does it mention there? I hope it doesn't. It does. Okay, so that's the principal cell, this one here. So what does the principal cell do? We just mentioned, where is the principal cell present? In the collecting tube. And this is where, this you got to know. You have to know this for your boards, for taking care of your patients. This is the important cell that you have to know for as far as potassium is concerned. And this is a cell where fine-tuning of potassium happens. So sodium potassium ATPase again here. These are the chloride channels at the bases. You have this channel, which is called the epithelial sodium channel, or the ENaC. And this is the ROMK channel, or the potassium channel, through which potassium recycles. So the ultrafiltrate comes down this way in the lumen, right? So the first thing that happens is the sodium potassium ATPase is active. It's getting rid of sodium and pushing in potassium into the cells. Because there are three sodiums removed for every two potassiums that are pushed into the cell, what happens to the electronegativity here? It's decreased, right? So now sodium enters, it's down this gradient into the cell. So when sodium enters, that causes potassium to leave the cells through here. So all this mechanism is aldosterone dependent. So we'll see in the next slide, aldo comes and activates the aldo receptor. The aldo receptor, when it's activated, then upregulates the sodium potassium ATPases. It upregulates the sodium channels and the activity of the potassium channels. And potassium is eventually gotten rid of in this segment of the tubule. Any questions so far? No. This is the intercalated cell, which is the neighboring cell to the principal cell. Here you have a hydrogen potassium ATPase. This is normally not active. It depends on the body's needs. ATPase or pump can be activated in severe hypokalemia when you need to reabsorb potassium, or in cases where you need to get rid of hydrogen ions. So where would you need to get rid of hydrogen ions? What situations would you need to get rid of hydrogen ions? So in acidosis, right? In acidosis, it gets activated because you need to get rid of hydrogen ions. Where in cases of hypokalemia, also it gets activated. Normally, it's not active. So these are the cells that you need to remember. The proximal cell right here, right? And then you have the thick ascending limb, the principal cell, and the intercalated cell. All right. So we talked about the principal cell. And if you just go back, you'll see this is the cell we talked about, which is the aldo-dependent mechanism, which is the main mechanism for fine-tuning of potassium. So just looking at this again, the same picture, I want you to learn at least this one cell pretty thoroughly by the end of the hour. So you have the ENaC, the orientation is a little bit different now. The luminal side is on this side. This is the basolateral side. So you have aldosterone coming and acting on the or attaching to the mineralocorticoid receptor, then which translocates then into the nucleus, increases the activity of the sodium potassium ATPase, opens up the sodium channels of the ENaC, epithelial sodium channels, and also opens up the potassium channels. So as you can see, sodium leaves the cell, sodium enters the cell through the luminal side, and potassium recycles here and eventually is gotten rid of. And aldosterone is the main mechanism for activating this, but you should also remember that cortisol is a very potent activator of this mechanism. So in normal body, the concentrations of cortisol are many, many thousand times more than aldosterone. So obviously, you would expect this mechanism to be active even though there's no aldo, but that doesn't happen. And the reason that doesn't happen is because cortisol, as soon as it's released in the body, gets converted to cortisone by this enzyme 11-beta-hydroxydehydrogenase. And cortisone is inactive on this mechanism. It has no activity. Okay? That's why the cortisol is present in very high concentrations. It has no effect on this aldo-mediated mechanism unless you have a deficiency of the 11-beta-hydroxydehydrogenase, in which case you're just, swamped with all this cortisol in the body, which then acts on the aldosterone receptor and activates this whole mechanism. And what is that what is that syndrome called, where you have all this where you have all this cortisol acting as aldosterone? So it could be acquired or congenital. So if you're born with it, obviously you don't have this enzyme from birth, but you could also acquire a deficiency of this by consuming certain things like licorice, okay, which blocks this enzyme. So it's called the syndrome of apparent mineralocorticoid excess, because it looks like there's a lot of mineralocorticoid or aldosterone around, but there's not really. It's a cortisol excess, but you can't convert it's not even a cortisol excess. It's a normal cortisol which cannot be converted to cortisone because of the lack of this enzyme. Okay, so that's why it's different from Cushing's. Any questions so far? Please feel free to stop me if you have any questions. So then that brings... So that's the basic physiology that I would like you guys to understand. So first of all, you ingest potassium. The first defense mechanism is to transcellularly shift potassium into the cell. The next mechanism is to get rid of the potassium either by the GI tract, sweat, or renal. Renal excretion is the most important mechanism. GI tract, you don't get rid of a lot of potassium unless the patient has diarrhea, right? The second mechanism, sweat, again, you don't sweat so much that you're losing a lot of potassium. So the main mechanism for getting rid of potassium from the body is via the kidneys. And the kidneys, proximal tubules, what happens? Reabsorbs potassium, pretty passive. There's no special mechanism for potassium reabsorption. Thick case in England, we talked about it. There's a sodium potassium 2-chloride channel, which can be blocked with Lasix. And those two account for most of the reabsorption of potassium. When it comes distally, about 10 to 20% gets delivered distally. Some of it gets reabsorbed in the distal connecting tubule. And the remainder, which is about 5 to 10, reaches even further down. And the main piece of the segment of the nephron that fine-tunes potassium is the principal cell. So that mechanism is aldo-dependent. So the way it works is the mechanism is very, very effective and efficient. Aldo is stimulated when you are hyperkalemic. So if you've ingested a lot of potassium, it upregulates aldo secretion. So when there's aldo around, the potassium channels open up and the patient gets rid of potassium. And the opposite is true too. When you're hypokalemic, there's depression of aldo secretion and the potassium channels don't open up. And actually, in fact, the hydrogen potassium ATPase in the intercalated cells get upregulated and you get reabsorbed potassium. So that's the basic physiology. There's a lot more, but if you remember that, that's great. Hypokalemia. I'm starting with hypokalemia because you probably kind of tend to ignore hypokalemia. Hyperkalemia is on everybody's radar. Everybody's, calling renal for a potassium of 5.1. You get a renal consult. But potassiums of even 2 and 2.5 are ignored because it's obviously not approached the same way, and it's not through any fault of yours. It's just not stressed enough, I think. And it's important because hypokalemia can have disastrous consequences too. Why is it important to maintain potassium in such a tight range? So even hypokalemia can do the same thing as hyperkalemia, cardiac arrhythmias. And every cell in the body needs potassium to be in that range for proper functioning, for protein synthesis. You need that for a lot of other things. For your muscles to have the correct action potential, you need potassium in that range. So you can't have a low potassium and expect the patient to be fine. So there's something called spurious hypokalemia. So just as in hyperkalemia, you got to make sure that this is real. But assuming it's real, the first thing you want to make sure if you see a patient with the potassium of 2.2, that there is no mechanism through which transcellular shift is happening. So what are the things? These are the things we already talked about: alkalemia, insulin excess, beta agonists. So this could be you've given them a lot of beta agonists because the patient is having an asthma exacerbation, or that the patient is stressed out and there's a catecholaminergic surge, right? Then there's certain drugs that can cause transcellular shifts. Hypokalemic periodic paralysis, where there's a shift of potassium into the cells because there is a problem with the sodium potassium ATPase in those patients. You could also have these other conditions which can cause. So you got to basically rule out, I don't expect you to memorize these, but rule out the conditions that can cause a transcellular shift of potassium into the cells when you see a low potassium. Then, obviously, then the next thing that you want to do is see if the patient is taking in enough potassium or not. So the common scenario where you would expect a low potassium intake is what? That you see quite a bit. Okay, bulimia, anorexia, we don't see that much of that here, but alcohol intoxication, because these patients are not eating, they're just drinking or binge drinking, and they have a very poor PO intake. And not only that, we'll see in the next few slides, when you aren't ingesting that much alcohol, you're losing magnesium, because it causes patients to lose, it causes a magnesium leak, basically. And when you have that, it's very difficult to correct your hypokalemia. So there's a it's multifactorial, basically, in patients who are drinking a lot of alcohol. So the next thing you want to look at is their PO intake of potassium. Is it decreased because the patient is malnourished and cachectic? Is it because the patient is just drinking alcohol and not eating? This could be a variety of reasons. Or maybe the patient is in the ICU, is not being fed. That could be the reason too. So there's a lot of reasons why the PO intake might be less. Or it could be because the patient is losing potassium. So the two main mechanisms that we're going to look at is renal and extrarenal, right? Any questions? No? So let's finish up with the extrarenal losses. So there's various ways you could look at a patient with a low potassium. The easiest way to do it, how do you differentiate between renal and extrarenal? This slide shows you how to do that. You could look at the urinary potassium. You could do a FEK, like the FE sodium. You could do a FE potassium and figure out if the patient is losing potassium or not. What would you expect the FEK to be in someone who has hypokalemia? Okay, so if the kidneys are normal and you have a normal conserving mechanism, your FEK should be low, right? So you look at the renal, you look at the loss of potassium in the urine. So if it's extrarenal losses, the patient has diarrhea, let's say. So you would expect the FEK to be low, appropriately so. But if you have a urinary loss for whatever reason, then though the patient is hypokalemic, he's still continuing to lose potassium and the FEK is going to be high. Does that make sense? Okay. So then you could start looking at it in a variety of ways. This is just one way of looking at it. Then you decide to see if the patient has metabolic acidosis, what is the acid-base status, does the patient have alkalosis. And again, these are some of the reasons why a patient might have laxative abuse and diarrhea are the two most common ones why the patient might have extrarenal losses. Now let's look at the renal losses. We just said the urinary potassium has to be high in face of hypokalemia to define it as a renal loss. And when you have this, let's look at this. Most common cause, metabolic acidosis with hypokalemia. And the first thing that should come to your mind is an RTA. That's probably the reason why the patient is hypokalemic, because he's losing potassium by the kidneys. So there's different kinds of RTAs, 1, 2, and 4. 4 we're not going to talk about because it's typically hyperkalemic and not hypokalemic, so it's not on the slide. But type 1 and 2 can be hypokalemic, and we're not going to get into the details of that, but there are other reasons why the patient might have metabolic acidosis and hypokalemia, okay? You could have a metabolic alkalosis and hypokalemia, and we'll look at that in the next slide. And there could be other reasons why the patient has hypokalemia. For example, the patient is polyuric because he's recovering from ATN, or maybe he's polyuric because you've relieved obstruction and now he's polyuric. The couple of other things that you have to remember, magnesium depletion, unless you correct the magnesium depletion, it'll be very difficult to control the potassium levels, and we'll see why that is so. Maybe I have a slide for that. Drugs, very frequently ignored. Aminoglycosides, not used that much anymore, but that can cause severe potassium losses renally. Cisplatin, those of you who have done oncology know that patients who are on cisplatin lose a lot of potassium. They're hypokalemic, they're hypomagnesemic. Typically, it resolves when you take them off the medications, but in some cases, it could be permanent. Okay? So if you have hypokalemia and acidosis, I said you got to think of RTAs, right? If you have hypokalemia and alkalosis, how do you approach this? The best way to approach metabolic alkalosis, since we are on the topic, we can talk about it for 2 seconds. The first thing you want to do, first of all, if you see, how do you make a diagnosis of metabolic alkalosis? Okay, good. So just the bicarb is not enough. You got to do a pH, and then you define the patient as having metabolic alkalosis. The next thing you want to do is find out whether this is a contraction alkalosis, a volume-responsive alkalosis, or it's a volume-resistant alkalosis, right? That's the easiest way to remember alkalosis. So again, the easiest thing will be to look at the urinary chloride. If the urinary chloride is less than 10, that means it's volume-responsive. And there could be a variety of reasons. Maybe the patient is having nasogastric suction, or maybe he's losing a lot of fluid in another form, and that's causing him to have low urinary chloride and a volume-responsive alkalosis. If the patient has a high urinary chloride, it's usually associated with hypertension, but sometimes you could have normotensive patients with alkalosis. So let's look at the normotensive population first. So when the patient has high urinary chloride, metabolic alkalosis, hypokalemia, these are the things you want to think of. I think there's a patient in-house right now in whom some of these are being entertained. So diuretics can definitely do that. Bartter's, Gitelman's, and some congenital potassium wasting disorders. Anybody want to take a shot at what Bartter's and Gitelman is? Okay. Right. So it's basically like being on a loop diuretic, right? So it acts the same way as Lasix. It's a congenital disorder where you have an inactivating mutation of the sodium potassium 2-chloride channel, so it's like being on Lasix all your life from the day you're born. So these patients have a contraction alkalosis and have hypokalemia, and they're normotensive or even hypotensive. These are called the hypotensive disorders, okay? And the patients typically, because it's like being on Lasix, also tend to be hypercalciuric, which means they're prone to forming renal stones, okay? The other one, the Gitelman's, is like being on a thiazide diuretic. So you'd expect the same things as being on a thiazide diuretic. It blocks the sodium, not blocks, they have an inactivating mutation of the sodium chloride channel in the distal tubule, in the distal connecting duct. And these patients have the same features, many of the same features. They're normotensive or hypotensive, have metabolic alkalosis, have low potassium. And the other distinguishing features, they do not have hypercalciuria, because typically patients who are on a thiazide diuretic are not hypercalciuric, right? That's why you give it as treatment for patients with stones, because you want to decrease the amount of calcium that's coming out in the urine. But it does the opposite. It causes hypercalcemia, right? So it could cause hypercalcemia, and it's also associated with hypomagnesemia. So those are the normotensive disorders associated with metabolic alkalosis and a high urinary chloride. How about the hypertensive disorders? Any clues what those might be which cause metabolic alkalosis, hypokalemia, and hypertension? Very good. So hyperaldosterone. Any hyperaldosterone, primary or secondary. So it could be Kahn's, it could be secondary hyperaldosterone. So alkalosis, always look for the urinary chloride. If it's less, obviously you got to do it before you start giving them IV fluids, because then it's going to be not going to be very useful if you start giving them saline and then do the urinary chloride. You see them in the ER, the SMRs, especially if you get called for a bicarb of 30, the first thing you say is, wait, don't give him fluids yet, let me get a urinary chloride on this guy. And it's not just intellectual curiosity, you could also treat the patient appropriately if you know what you're dealing with, right? So you do the urinary chloride. If it's less than 10, it points towards volume-sensitive alkalosis, and maybe that's the reason why the patient is hypokalemic as well. If it's more than 20, kind of rules out volume-sensitive alkalosis, then you want to see if the patient is normotensive or hypertensive. If it's normotensive, it's probably, could be, Bartter's and Gitelman's are not common in adults. It's a disease of pediatrics, but you have to entertain it. Sometimes it can manifest a little bit later, or maybe it just went undiagnosed early on in age, but you wouldn't expect it to manifest at age 80. You know, it's probably in the young adults that you would see it. If it's hypertensive disorder, then you got to think of all the states that can cause a high aldo level. So it could be renal vascular disease, it could be adrenal adenoma here, or hyperplasia, or it could be what we just mentioned, a syndrome of apparent mineralocorticoid excess where you have a mutation in the gene, or maybe the patient is eating licorice which blocks 11-beta hydroxydehydrogenase, or maybe the patient has some other etiology like Cushing's that contributes to the hypertension, alkalosis, and hypokalemia. All right, let's just skip that. We looked at that already. We talked about this. So this, I want to introduce to you what something called Little syndrome that might show up on the boards, and that's something that you will hear the nephrologist talk about. Little syndrome is where you have an activating mutation of the epithelial sodium channel, where we just looked at it, I think it was a couple of slides ago. This channel, the sodium channel, the epithelial sodium channel is activated. It's an activating mutation, which means it remains open all the time, and patients keep reabsorbing sodium all the time. As a result, what is their blood pressure? They're usually hypertensive because their volume expanded and they're reabsorbed a lot of salt. And the reason it's important is because more and more studies are finding out that it's not as uncommon as we used to think. It's probably more common than we thought. We just didn't look for it in enough patients with hypertension. And these patients can present with very difficult to control hypertension, alkalosis, hypokalemia, all the things that we talked about, because when you reabsorb sodium, you're getting rid of potassium in the principal cells. Always remember that. When you reabsorb sodium, it's got to be sodium for potassium. So the patients tend to be hypokalemic in those situations, right? And it's something that you got to think about. How do you diagnose it? There's genetic testing for these mutations. There are special labs that do that. And the reason you want to do it is because you want to counsel the families. You know, if you have patients with, like, five siblings are all very hypertensive at a very young age, and they want to find out why. And it's not that difficult to treat, because the treatment would be blocking the epithelial sodium channel from reabsorbing sodium. So what would do that? What drug would block that epithelial sodium channel? Let's start here. Amiloride. Yeah, exactly. It blocks the epithelial sodium channel, so it's a diuretic. It blocks the sodium channel, so it has a dual effect. So that would be the drug of choice. Okay. So let's go to the clinical manifestations of hypokalemia. Why is it important? Why do we even care if the patient is hypokalemic or not? We mentioned that cardiac arrhythmias are very top on our list. We don't want our patients to have more problems than they already have. So it also predisposes patients to digitalis toxicity. Right, we all know that. So if a patient is on DIG, the intern is told on day number one, if the patient is on DIG, check the potassium, don't let it go below 3. The reason is because if you're hypokalemic, you are predisposed to DIG toxicity. Neuromuscular, we talked about, you could have dysfunction of various muscles, smooth muscle, bladder dysfunction, GI tract, you know, skeletal muscle. You could even have rhabdomyolysis from severe hypokalemia. How about the kidneys? What is it? Does it do anything to the kidneys? Take a guess. Don't look at the slide. It says there in the back. Does hypokalemia, not this part, you guys have been. You got to move to the other group. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Okay, very good. So it interferes with the concentrating ability of the principal cells. So that's where the urine gets concentrated, right? ADH acts on the principal cells, and we're not going to get into that. But hypokalemia does have renal renal manifestations. And it's important because if you don't correct it, the patients tend to be polyuric, right? If you're not concentrating your urine, you're putting out 3 to 4 liters of urine a day, and you're losing more potassium. So it's like a cycle that you've generated, and you got to take care of that. It also can cause structural alterations, and there have been many reports of how it can cause proximal tubular damage. It causes vacuolization of the cells and so on. It also can cause decrease in insulin secretion, which has, again, been reported on in quite extensively. So there's a lot of factors that can be influenced by having a very low serum potassium. It's not just the cardiac arrhythmias, but there's a lot more than that. So this is a typical EKG. Again, these are just estimates. Every patient is different, and you have to remember that there will be an interpatient variability. But typically, so does anybody want to describe what are the changes with hypokalemia on an EKG? Okay. So depression of the ST segment is one of the first things that you'll see, right? And then the U waves appear, and then there's widening of the QRS complex, okay? This is something that I put this slide in because I want you guys to remember that I typically see on the floors, we get called for a potassium of 2.5. The intern has been told by his resident, called renal, don't ask any questions, just call them. And then we say, okay, how much potassium did you give the patient? And he says, well, 20 milliequivalents. So you got to remember that for every milliequivalent that your serum potassium goes down by, you're probably in a negative balance of about 700 to 800 milliequivalents of potassium, total body potassium. So giving the 20 milliequivalents and hoping that the potassium is going to come up is not going to work. So you got to be aggressive. If the patient has normal renal function, there's no reason why the patient cannot be given more potassium, okay? So you could give it orally. You could give it more frequently, 40 milliequivalents every 4 hours. But giving it orally, you got to remember that it's a gastric irritant, so you can't give all 100 milliequivalents at once and say, oh, you'll be fine. He's not going to take the next dose if you do that. Giving it IV, you got to be careful too because you don't want to replete it all at once because it predisposes to cardiac arrhythmias, okay? So don't be so stingy when you give potassium. If the creatinine is fine, you could be generous with the potassium. So how do you treat hypokalemia? Obviously, if there's any correctable, reversible cause, you stop it. If the patient is on diuretics and is not in florid pulmonary edema, you can stop the diuretics. If the patient has magnesium deficiency, we talked about it a couple of times already, you treat the magnesium deficiency. Why does magnesium depletion cause hypokalemia, or why does it perpetuate hypokalemia? This is another thing the interns are taught, right? Look at the potassium and look at the magnesium. If the magnesium is low, give him the magnesium too, not just the potassium. But why is that? Magnesium and calcium go between the cells, not the potassium. No. He's related to the kidney, okay. let's get that straight, okay. All right, so the reason why hypomagnesemia causes hypokalemia is because we looked at the principal cell. We saw that there's an influx of sodium and an efflux of potassium, right? That is a gated mechanism. It's not like the sodium channel is remaining open all the time unless you have Little syndrome, right? It opens and closes depending on the body's needs for sodium and potassium and how much aldo is around and all that. So when you have no magnesium or low magnesium, the potassium channels apparently tend to remain open, and the gating mechanisms disappear. So you're losing potassium, though you have a need to hold on to potassium. So that's why it's important to correct the magnesium deficiency. So if the patient is asymptomatic and has hypokalemia and you've taken care of the reversible causes, then you got to remember that it's important but not that urgent. So you can give them oral potassium citrate, oral bicarbonate, and you know, if the patient needs volume, you're going to give it. Or you could even give a potassium-sparing diuretic if the patient is hypertensive, right? if the patient is symptomatic or is on digitalis and you're afraid that the patient is going to have an arrhythmia, then you start with the intravenous replacement. You could give up to 40 milliequivalents per hour, depending on whether the patient has a central line or not, because giving potassium peripherally is very uncomfortable, and if it extravasates, it can cause a problem. And if you're giving a lot of potassium, you got to have them on some kind of a monitored setting, because dumping in potassium can also predispose to arrhythmias because it alters the action potential pretty rapidly in the cardiac cells. All right, questions? So you guys all know how to take care of hypokalemia now. All right. How about our friend hyperkalemia? You guys know this, right? We don't have to spend too much time on hyperkalemia. You see this all the time. You're told from day one, and you're all pros. Let's look at some of the stuff that may not be that familiar to you guys. So obviously, spurious hyperkalemia, we always tell you, make sure if you can't find a cause why the patient is hyperkalemic, you got to think, maybe this is not real, right? So a lot of times, you know, the resident will say, oh, you've been asking him to clench the fist for too long, or you're using a very narrow bore needle, and that's why the patient has now hemolyzed, and this is just hemolysis, don't worry about it. Can you differentiate between hemolysis and true hyperkalemia? How would you find out whether this is spurious or not? You repeat, okay, you repeat. And the resident comes and says, you're good for nothing, you know, you've done it again, you've done it 5 times, you still don't know how to draw bloods, and, you know, it's 90 days since you started or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, look for whether it says hemolyzed or not. Yeah. You could do a serum versus plasma potassium, right? Why do you get a spurious elevation when the blood clots? Right. The cells break down and release potassium. And in addition to having tied the tourniquet tight, having had the patient clench and unclench and all that thing, if you have the blood sitting for too long, the cells can lyse and cause potassium to be released from the cells. So you could do a plasma potassium. So you could, there's a special tube that you need to take the blood in. It's EDTA tube. Send it off to the lab and tell them that this is a plasma potassium you want to check to make sure that it's true hyperkalemia. Then you got to look at what, again, the same thing as hypokalemia. Is there any reason why the patient might have a transcellular shift that's causing the patient to be hyperkalemic? Since we have one person here that I know who's going into anesthesia, let's look at succinylcholine. Why does that cause hyperkalemia? Who is it? Okay, David, raise your hand. Well, who I know. Right, so it causes more potassium exit from the cells and causes hyperkalemia. And you got to know certain patients are predisposed to this, and when you give them succinylcholine, they can have a cardiac arrhythmia. So just something to remember. Okay, and if the patient has decreased renal function, obviously you know that that's probably the most likely cause why the patient is hyperkalemic, though it could be multifactorial. You could have the patient eating a lot of potassium and not getting rid of it. When the patient has renal insufficiency, you got to know that your renal insufficiency has to be really advanced for you to be hyperkalemic. GFR has to be really, really low, like less than 10 ml per minute or even 5 ml per minute. If you have a GFR of 30 to 40, there's no reason for the patient to be hyperkalemic unless there's an underlying potassium secretory defect in addition to the low GFR, for example, an RTA or, you know, some other reason why the patient is hyperkalemic, okay?
It just occurred to me the EDTA tubes we have here are potassium EDTA.
You can go to the lab and they'll give it to you.
EDTA.
Yeah. That's a good point, though, because you don't want to draw it in the potassium EDTA. Okay, so some of the other causes for high potassium, other than what we already talked about, is exogenous potassium, potassium-rich foods. Again, if you have normal mechanisms of handling potassium, you shouldn't be hyperkalemic, otherwise we would all be hyperkalemic. So if the patient is consuming a normal diet, has a normal renal function, and is hyperkalemic, then you got to think of an RTA in that situation, okay? And the RTA that causes hyperkalemia, we just said, what type of RTA? Type 4. And certain type 1s can also cause hyperkalemia, but typically it's type 4. Other reasons why a patient can be hyperkalemic is if they have tumor lysis syndrome, rhabdomyolysis, if they're getting a lot of blood transfusions, right? They're having a GI bleed. Drugs. This is just a short list. Potassium-sparing diuretics, you got to remember. It's not uncommon for us to get consults and, you know, the house staff hasn't done their job of looking through the medications that can cause hyperkalemia, and they say, oh, the potassium has been high. And, you know, we look like heroes. We go there and say, okay, this is the reason why the potassium is high. Discontinue the medication, and in a couple of days, the potassium comes down. So pay attention to what your patients are getting. Non-steroidals can cause hyperkalemia. Does anybody know how? Okay, so we said that fine-tuning of potassium is aldo-dependent. So any mechanism that interferes with aldo-secretion will cause a patient to be hyperkalemic. So non-steroidals decrease renin production. So when you have no renin, you have no aldosterone. So when you have hypoaldo states, you get hyperkalemic, okay? Angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, it's obvious. The receptor blockers can also cause hyperkalemia and to a lesser extent, but it's seen. Heparin is another one that's not on the list here, I think, but heparin can cause hyperkalemia. Any clue? And it's seen quite commonly in our population, at least. Do you know how heparin can cause hyperkalemia? And it's not dose dependent. It can happen with sub-Q heparin. It can happen with IV bolus heparin. And that's a medication that almost every patient is on, right? Excellent. So it stops aldosynthesis in some patients and can cause hypoaldo states and cause hyperkalemia. And this can happen even when the patient is on just sub-Q heparin for prophylaxis. So that's something that you got to remember. And if you've exhausted every other cause for hyperkalemia and you think that's the cause, obviously you got to use some other way of prophylaxis, maybe SCDs for these patients. Okay? Any questions? There are other medications too. You know, Bactrim can cause hyperkalemia. Anything that blocks the epithelial sodium channel that we saw just now in the principal cell can cause hyperkalemia. So Bactrim is one that blocks that. The potassium-sparing diuretics do that. Pentamidine doesn't act through that mechanism but can also cause hyperkalemia. Okay, so there's a lot of medications that can do that. It's reported, I think the literature says about 5% of patients, but we've seen it more often than that in our population. There are other medications on this list. We're not going to go through this. You can read this from your textbooks. Let's look at how do you...
Is it possible that someone who has been on heparin for a long time develops hyperkalemia?
Yeah, apparently it can happen at any time on heparin, and it's not dose-related. It's just one of those weird things that could happen. So just to introduce you to another topic, it's called the transtubular potassium gradient. I guess it's a terminology. It's a way of finding out how much potassium the patient is excreting in the urine. So you could do a fractional excretion of potassium, but there's a more sophisticated way of looking at is the potassium excretion appropriate or not for the level of serum potassium, and that's called the TTKG. And you make a few assumptions in calculating the TTKG. The assumptions are listed here. You assume that there is negligible potassium secretion or reabsorption after the principal cell. You assume that the final urinary K is equal to or greater than the plasma K, and you also make the assumption that the urine potassium increases not because of secretion into the urine from after the principal cell, but because of water reabsorption. So if we really believe that these are all true, then you could use this formula to calculate the TTKG. And this is the formula here. You don't have to memorize it. But basically, it's the same concept again. If you have low serum potassium, you would expect the TTKG to be low. Right? It should be an appropriate response. You're reabsorbing the potassium. If you have a high TTKG and a low serum potassium, that means you have a potassium secretory. You have a potassium losing defect. And if you have a hyperkalemia and a high TTKG, that means it's appropriate. If you have hyperkalemia and a low TTKG, that means you have a problem getting rid of potassium, okay? So that's kind of self-explanatory. We talked about a lot of these. We're not going to get into all the details. We talked about this. So manifestations of hyperkalemia, again, cardiac arrhythmias are number one on the list. You could have neuromuscular dysfunction, and you could have some renal abnormalities, decreased renal ammonium production, and endocrine effects are, it can cause increased aldosecretion, which is an appropriate response because it's the body's mechanism of getting rid of potassium. It can also cause increased insulin secretion. Again, EKG changes, this I guess you guys are more familiar with, P waves, and then you have, finally, there's widening of the QRS complex and sine waves. Again, this is very patient dependent. These are just approximations. You could have a patient with potassium of 6 with the CKG, and you could have a potassium of 9 and still have the CKG. So you can just use this as gold standard. Okay. How do you treat? You have to rule out spurious hyperkalemia. And this is important. You guys all have to know this, and I'm sure you do. Don't wait for the renal person to come and see the patient. Start treating the hyperkalemia immediately. So what's the immediate thing that you want to do for patients who are hyperkalemic? Calcium gluconate, because we said the main effect of hyperkalemia is on the cardiac muscles. So to try to prevent arrhythmias, you give them calcium gluconate. Then you could give them, you know, insulin to try to push the potassium into the cells. Obviously, you give them glucose so that they don't become hypoglycemic. You can use the albuterol nebulizers because beta agonists push potassium into the cells. But to get this effect, you really have to use a lot of beta agonists, and the patients are tachycardic like anything when you do that. So it's probably not something that I would recommend in most cases. You could give K-Axlate, but you got to remember that's going to take a while to act. It doesn't act immediately. It might be a few hours. It might be faster to get the patient on hemodialysis if that's indicated.
Is there a severity range of hyperkalemia where you would start giving
treatment? Well, that's a good question. So EKG changes, you got to remember, it can happen at any time. So my recommendation would be any potassium over 5.5, you got to treat them. Because I've seen patients with a potassium of 6 go into arrhythmias, and you don't want to wait till they go into an arrhythmia. So giving calcium gluconate and insulin. Insulin is fine if they do not have renal insufficiency, right? If they have a renal insufficiency, you have to be very careful because that delays their half-life of insulin, and then you have complications of hypoglycemia in these patients. But anything over 5.5, I would recommend that. You have to be very vigilant and start treating. Okay? And it depends on whether it's acute or not. Patients who have chronic hyperkalemia usually have adapted to it and don't have the same consequences as someone who's suddenly becoming hyperkalemic. Okay. So that's potassium. Any questions? Because when you're treating anemias, any anemia, more so megaloblastic anemia, you start making red cells. So these new red cells are now using up the potassium. So you tend to get hypokalemic in that. And also hypophosphatemic. So are you guys still up to talking about calcium, or are you exhausted?
Okay.
Let's see. Let's vote here. We could do it another time. Okay. What time is it?
6:30.
Okay, so why don't we... Where's the chief resident? So let's party now that he's not here. Oh, let me turn this off. These guys are tired. I don't know how to turn this off. These guys are tired. They want to do calcium another time. Is that
okay?
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.